Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th. And it's making me feel joy. Woo! And sadness. Oh. And anger. Definitely some disgust.
Rose!
And I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Welcome to WMFA, a podcast about why and how we write. I'm Courtney Ballastier, and this week I'm speaking with Simon Hahn. Simon is the author of Nights When Nothing Happened, out now from Riverhead Books. His stories and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The Texas Observer, Guernica, The Iowa Review, Electric Literature, and Lit Hub. The recipient of several fiction awards and arts fellowships, he was born in Tianjin, China, and raised in various cities in Texas.
Maybe one day I'll be like writing till 3 a.m. because I just want to chase this thread in my head and I don't want to let it go. And then another day, yeah, it's more like I'm revising or I'm just reading someone else's work and I'm just letting things influence me in a sort of more mysterious way.
Nights When Nothing Happened is, as its title suggests, a novel of subtle movements and opaque atmospheres. Inside the home of the Changs, a Chinese family living in suburban Dallas, everyone struggles to understand each other. Husband and father Liang is sullen. Wife and mother Patty is evasive. Their older child, a son named Jack, who spent his early years with his grandparents in China, struggles to find his role in the nuclear family. And their young daughter, Annabelle, born in the United States, exhibits increasingly difficult behavior. She also, unbeknownst to her parents, has started sleepwalking around their neighborhood. Without giving away too much, I'll say that an allegation of impropriety against children becomes central to the movement of the novel and reverberates throughout it. Simon deftly fits this accusation into the larger, more complicated context he's created, that of a family that feels like strangers to one another and to their neighbors inside a community that's built on uniformity. As the fallout from the accusation ensues, Nights When Nothing Happened explores how well we can ever know even our most intimate relationships, not to mention our understanding of the world around us. As Simon and I discuss here, Nights When Nothing Happened is an immigrant novel in that it is a novel about characters who are immigrants. But we also talk about how it was important to him that the book not be seen as another more limiting conception of an immigrant novel often found in our literary dialogue. We also talk about the tricky label of universality, his favorite character to write, and how he turned this project from a short story into a novel. At WMFA's Patreon page, Simon and I talk about writing the suburbs, and why, for all our derision of them, they have something important to say about American life. You can hear this and other bonus segments by visiting patreon.com/WMFA podcast and pledging just $2 a month. I wanted to start actually by kind of asking you about the title, Nights When Nothing Happened, and sort of talking about where that might have come from and kind of what it means to you. I know titles are, you know, maybe even not necessarily always the writer's choice, but how do you see it kind of playing into the events of the book?
Yeah, I feel like the title, I'm sort of asking for kind of like puns to be used if someone doesn't quite like the book or something, like, oh, nothing happens. But I do think that there's an element of like winking to the reader there, because obviously things do happen in the book. Things do happen during these nights that the characters are experiencing. But I'm interested in like how they define what nothing is versus what something is. I think it all kind of goes back to this idea of like the stories that we tell of our own lives. like, for example, in thinking about the suburbs as being a place where nothing happens, like there is an element of truth to that. I mean, anyone who's spent time in the suburbs can probably attest to that. But it's also an easy story to tell. I think what I wanted to explore, not just through the title, but through the book, is like why this characterization persists so much in the wider imagination, and how this idea of like these safe civil neighborhoods with like-minded people and like no conflict, and like how that is itself a myth, and that there's always something happening under the surface, these pressures and these people who are overlooked. And yeah, everyone's just carrying their something.
Right. I'm thinking as you're saying that of the scene of Liang walking home from the poker night and making the observation that like all of these complexes have these walls but no gates. So it's like, right, it's not like it's really keeping anybody out, but there's this pretense of like, well, this is what the facade looks like.
Right, right. Yeah. If when you like really, I don't know that much about architecture, but when you start thinking about just on the surface, like how homes are constructed and like, what are they trying to say? What story are they trying to tell in the way these neighborhoods are designed? That was part of the challenge and the driving force of the novel, is to just keep asking questions that peel back, you know, the surface.
Right. Well, and I mean, it's such a, like a neighborhood like the one the Chengs live in is such a, it's such an archetype of the American dream, right? It's like, well, this is what you're striving for, ostensibly, this kind of like cookie cutter-ish, but, you know, very like, well, you'll get the house, check. You'll get the Christmas decorations, check. You'll have the two vehicles in the driveway, check.
Yeah, yeah. Christmas decorations especially, I think, is a very unique suburban obligation.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe not unique just to suburbia, but this idea of like, are you going to participate in this ritual, even if you don't celebrate Christmas, right? Like everybody else on your street has these Christmas lights. I remember, even because I did grow up for a large part of my life in the suburbs, I remember like there was this one community where we would all, like in the book, there's this community that we would all like drive through during the holidays because they had the best Christmas lights. But like, what if you lived in that community and like didn't want to put Christmas lights? Like, pretty wild.
Yeah, I definitely growing up, we had one of those neighborhoods too, where like a block that was like, and it was the same block that like on Halloween, that's where you got like the full size candy. It was like
right,
the block.
Right.
It's like they had like the good Christmas decorations. But yeah, now that I'm an adult, you're right. You just think more of the perspective from the perspective of these parents who are like, oh my God, do I have to like go through all of this expense and effort? And a thing that's really interesting that all of these factors about the setting kind of play in the book is there's this sort of peer pressure that exists, you know, no matter who you are in these neighborhoods, to kind of, you know, present this certain way. But then also this particular family has that that other layer of pressure of being Chinese American and feeling that sort of distance from a lot of their neighbors as well. Did you see those things kind of playing together?
Yeah, I wanted very much for this book not to just be a kind of us versus them kind of conflict.
Yeah.
Where the them is usually like white people, or like, and then non-white people versus white people. I think the reality of what America looks like today is much more nuanced than that. And this family itself, like, because they are coming from a different context, they have experienced all this turmoil in their home country. And then there's the turmoil of immigration and the various gulfs that have sort of risen up among them within the family, that I wanted to also look sort of not just like the house versus the other houses on the street, but look within the house itself and think about the particular pressures there. I mean, the external threats are still applying a kind of pressure onto the family dynamics, but these are family members that are kind of strangers to themselves too. And part of that is trying to understand like where they come from, and they all come from different contexts.
Right. There is a very nocturnal atmosphere in this family. You know, like for one thing, Annabelle with her sleepwalking, which is just like a concept I'm obsessed with and would love to just like talk about for, because just like sleep, if you think too long about it, freaks me out.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, like I just find sleep kind of gross and weird. And it's like, And then, you know, we're so incapacitated. And so like, she doesn't remember all of these things that she's doing. And, she's walking around, she's leaving the house at certain times. And I really like the ways that you get into her consciousness. I want to ask you a little bit more later about that. But yeah, she doesn't even know. She's like, well, maybe I dreamt that, or maybe I didn't. But everybody's engagements with each other within the family are kind of shadowy, and you never really know. I got the sense that nobody ever really understood anyone else in their nuclear family, which you don't. I mean, I guess a lot, not ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, who can really fully know another person? I mean, it sounds like such a basic thing, but within a family, there's this kind of obligation that somehow like you're born into it. And so you're sort of born into a kind of intimacy, but that itself is a kind of myth too, right? Like it's maybe even harder to get to know your own family because it requires a level of engagement that can be very scary. And like you feel like there's a lot at stake, like losing a relationship, say with a friend that you've been friends with for a couple years, and there's just the falling out. I mean, that's certainly hard, but like family are people that you are still tied to in some way. And I think you often risk more when you try to really get to know another person in your family. I imagine this is something that a lot of families are going through these past few years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think, part of the built-in conflict of that is like how hard it is to change sort of your role within a family, like once if you're kind of perceived a way that you don't really want to be perceived, or maybe that you want a little bit more, I don't know, autonomy or power. I'm thinking of Jack and the way he's kind of just trying to like figure out like what his job is in the family, and sort of like how, I feel like from the beginning, he's putting so much pressure on himself. But it's hard to kind of assert like the way that you want to, it's hard to assert to be seen the way you want to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, Jack is, so he's the boy in this family and the son. And, I mean, he was born in a country he can't remember, and or he's slowly starting to forget. And he's had to kind of like re-meet his parents, later in his life when he joins them in America. And I think as a result of that, he's feeling these sort of tenuous connections to people and places. And so like having a defined role in the family like would ground him. And so he's trying to constantly find that and prove himself, because I guess like he doesn't quite realize that like, at least with this family, it's possible that love can exist in an unconditional way. He feels like he's got to somehow earn it. And so, yeah, as children do, they find ways to do that, whether it's like modeling themselves off adults, or trying to be this protector figure for his younger sister. Yeah, I really feel for him.
Yeah, there was a line early on that really just got me when he was saying, he says something like he had made his grandparents frail, and now they were too frail to come with him. Mm-hmm. Just this feeling of just like, okay, well, I am responsible for everything, which like, I don't know, I guess like this window into my childhood psyche that like I resonate really strongly with, that feeling of like that no one necessarily puts on you, but, mm-hmm. but you're, you feel like your little shoulders have to like bear everything. And then that the dynamic with Annabelle kind of reinforces that, right? Cause she's tough. How do you, can you talk a little bit about like your relationship as a writer to the character of Annabelle?
Yeah, I love writing her character. I don't know that I could spend too much time with her. Like, if she was a real person, I would be it would be a lot. I would be tired. But I do love her as a character. I think because I felt like with her, I had the most room to play as a writer. You know, the mm-hmm. other three members of the family, they are a little bit more conflict avoidant, and they're trying to like slip in into, you know, other people's narratives and projections. But for Annabelle, she's very much like, you know, when she's in the room, you know, she really announces herself, and she has this ability to slip into different skins and different costumes, and while still being a child at heart. So there's so many places to go with her character that also would then sort of push forward the book itself and the action itself. So yeah, I thought she was a very necessary character, but also really liked spending time with her.
You've got this kind of like Machiavellian quality of just like, yeah. I don't know, she's devious. Like, there's something kind of devious about her. But makes for great movement. And what do you, I know this is so hard to pinpoint these sorts of things, but like, where in the development of Annabelle did the sleepwalking come in, and sort of what does that represent for you with her?
Yeah, let me try to think. I think fairly early on there was sleepwalking, and I think, I mean, it's not that the sleepwalking was the initial inspiration for writing the book. I think I wanted to capture this general mood and feeling of like being in a world which you feel like you're gradually losing control, not only like on your own security, but like your own grasp of reality. And sleepwalking felt like a perfect vehicle to explore that. So I think this book actually started as a short story, and in that story, Annabelle was sleepwalking and Jack was kind of following her, and that was one of the initial incidents that started off the story. It went in a different direction in the initial short story, but yeah, fairly early on, she was sleepwalking.
Did you kind of finish that short story and then just sort of felt like the characters weren't done?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like the story had an entire arc, but it also felt like the ending was kind of opening up to another story, or like the story that I really wanted to tell. So it almost felt like a prologue of sorts. And so when I just kept thinking about these characters, I thought, like, why not make it a novel? And I mean, that then there was this whole long process of doing that, and a lot of mistakes, in which I think this is maybe something a lot of writers who like expand short stories into a novel face, because I don't think this is as simple necessarily as just making the short story the first chapter of your book.
Right.
You've got to sort of change the scope and the structure a bit, because short stories and novels are such different beasts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny when you said that it felt like a prologue to the story that you really wanted to write. I was like, that's like 80% of my drafts, I feel like. It's like, okay, yeah. You're getting there.
right. I mean, I think Alexander Chi said something really helpful about that. Like, so much of what you're writing is like scaffolding. And you're like, you have to write it though to see what's kind of underneath and what the heart of the actual story is.
Yeah, for sure. But sorry, going back to the point that you had actually just made about, because the rhythms have to be so entirely different, right? You can't really sustain the short story sort of, I guess pace, although that's not entirely the word that I want to choose, but you know, like that sort of metabolism can't last for the length of the novel.
Yeah, that was my biggest struggle, because I had this dramatic event in the short story, and like, so that made me front load all the action in my novel, because my original draft of the novel, basically I didn't change much of the short story, I just made it the first chapter, but that meant there's this big dramatic thing that happened, and then when all the good stuff is in the first chapter, you're like, where do I go next? And like I tried a lot of different things. Like, one was to basically just change the kind of pitch of the novel and like start a new arc, but that felt kind of like a letdown because of all the dramatic stuff that happened in the first chapter. And then I tried to do the opposite, where I was sort of like escalating the next chapter, like escalating the action, and it just got more and more dramatic and dark to the point where I felt like the novel couldn't really sustain it. It was like, I don't know why I'm suddenly thinking about this, but you know, it's like the Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like in one movie, a car is literally like jumping out of a skyscraper and landing in another skyscraper. It's like, where do you go from there? Like,
where do you go from?
The next movie, the car is in outer space. And like, it works for Fast and Furious. Like, I love the series. It works for them because they really lean into it. Like, that's what the movies are all about. But maybe not like so much for my novel. So I had to sort of figure out what arc it really could sustain.
Right. Well, and that's really interesting to talk about, knowing, you know, not to give away really what happens in the book, but you know, there is this allegation of impropriety on the part of Leung, the father, and potentially to Annabelle, potentially to a neighbor girl, a friend of Annabelle's. And that's the sort of kind of like plot bomb that could really like sort of black hole, become like this kind of black hole for the narrative, you know, and sort of just like take it into this very different direction. But you do kind of weave it in a way that like, I don't know. I was really fascinated by the way that it sort of existed within the larger context of the story and kind of didn't overwhelm the story that was already being told, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my editor helped me so much with that, because like she helped me to see that like that event, which occurs sort of in the middle of the novel, like initially I had pushed it much earlier, and again, that put the kind of pressure on me to keep escalating. But she was like, you know, there's so much interesting stuff in the middle that you have yet to explore. Like, if you were to stretch it out, and sort of take more time delicately setting up the domino pieces, we would know these characters better and like what they're carrying up until that scene. And so yeah, it was just like, pacing was part of it, but it was also just allowing myself to be okay spending more time in those quiet moments that I think really are more where the heart of the novel is.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's one thing, you know, to the title, like it is a lot of, despite having just explained this kind of big, you know, capital D dramatic turn, it is a very quiet book in a lot of ways, and the things that, which tend to be my favorite to read, is the sort of just kind of like character studies where you can, you know, there's enough plot to move forward, but it's not like you're like, oh my god, I have to like skip to the end and make sure this person survives, or like all right. Those kind of high stakes things. And I think you do really feel for, I mean, that's part of what makes it such a such a visceral kind of reading experience when that comes, is because you really are feeling for everybody who's involved, even though all of the your sympathies are going in like 18 different directions, but you get why everybody is responding the way that they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the space in fiction that I'm most interested in exploring. I mean, there's certainly like villains in our world, but it just, yeah, I don't know. I'd rather like not waste my time on trolls. Like I liked spending time with flawed characters and spending time with characters who care about things, but also just have different ideas about how to get there.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that I thought was interesting, and I wanted to talk to you about, and I don't know if I'm like making this up, if I'm reading too much into things, but it occurred to me that Leung is the only one who is using a Chinese name in the family. And I wondered if that like had any significance for you in terms of, you know, any kind of subtext about like how he's relating to this experience versus how his family members are relating to this experience, just kind of being their lives. I mean, you know, nothing in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that question. I think I think the ways in which we choose our names, like what I mean is like when we, if you're an immigrant and you move sort of to another country, there's often this question of, do you keep, you know, the name that you used in your home country, or do you Americanize it? But I think that process is complicated. I remember like when I was in my MFA, there was a very well-meaning, you know, freshman that I was talking to in a sort of book club that we were setting up, and she was talking about how with all the international students, she always asks them like, what's your real name, because she wants to get to know the real them, and rather than the, if their name is like Wesley or Janice, like they wanted, right. She wanted to know their real names, and I think I understand where that's coming from, but I think that these international students are changing their names, yes, on one hand to accommodate, you know, non-Western people, but the process of it is also deeply personal, right? And mm-hmm. It's important in ways that we may not even understand. Like, for example, my legal name wasn't Simon until I became a citizen in my teens, but that's what I identify as. I can't imagine being Xingmeng, which was my legal name up until then. And I think for Liang, it's probably maybe something like that. I mean, I think Patty is someone who is very much in the world and in the workforce and is quicker to accommodate herself to others. And part of that is a strategy mm-hmm. for survival and for advancement. Whereas Liang is sort of, you know, he's spent his entire life struggling to have his own realities validated, and he's, you know, I don't want to put too much weight into the name, but I do think it may tie into that, whether consciously or unconsciously, just this idea of like, this is maybe one thing that he wants to hold on to, but I don't think that with Patty not with Patty changing her name, I don't see that as a kind of failure on her part either.
Right, yeah, and like you're saying, especially with the work context, and you know, I think too, like when you're talking about being accommodating, I think too, just like, yeah, being like a woman in the world, no matter like what kind of woman you are, you're kind of taught like that you should sort of just be easier to deal with. So all of that makes a lot of sense, yeah, and it's really interesting to think about those perspectives with. I really liked this touch with Annabelle where like she's a little bit obsessed with the idea of China, but like it seems with very little input from mm-hmm. her family, like she's just kind of obsessed with it as this idea that's like a little hard for her to grasp, that like, you know, she feels like she can like hear it like underground, like, you know, it's just like on the other side of the ground. Like she, yeah. So she's got this very kind of childlike enthusiasm about it, it's like this very intense connection, but then like very disconnected at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, she's the only one in the family that wasn't born in China. So,
right.
I mean, she knows very little about China, and maybe a lot of what she knows is like what other people who aren't from China are telling her about it. And I mean, I remember as a kid, there was always that, the kind of make-believe thing where you can dig a hole and you arrive in China, right? So I think she's probably thinking along those lines, but I think she's also feeling a lack there because she knows the rest of her family is from China. Mm. She feels like that there's a part of her family that they share, but she can't access. So it is intense, yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, and this is a little bit of a thorny question to ask, so I apologize in advance if I don't word it properly, but like I talk a lot with various writers on the show about this idea of having like a multiplicity of narratives and making sure that no one story is trying to be being interpreted, because it's usually in the interpretation, right, and not in the author's intention, as kind of like the definitive X experience. And so I wondered, you know, when mm-hmm. you were working on this and getting it ready to, you know, thinking about like what does this look like on the marketplace, and like where, you know, once you kind of start having those thoughts, right, once the story is kind of coming together, like, did you think much about what kind of story of the Chinese American identity you like did or didn't want to tell, or like, you know, does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Ideally, this is impossible, but this idea of like the creative process could exist in a vacuum, right? And that you could, that it could be protected from marketplace concerns. I mean, mm-hmm. whether consciously or unconsciously, I'm sure I did think about that. And now that I've like finished the novel and I'm like on the publicity stage, it's definitely like at the forefront of my mind. And I remember like having these initial discussions like with my publicist where I might have come across almost a little defensive when I was like, I don't want this to be like the quote unquote immigrant novel. And I didn't really like, I didn't do a good job of explaining like what I meant by that, because like it is an immigrant novel. Like these are immigrants and this is a novel. But I guess I was thinking about how almost the genre of it, of immigrant novel, has become a bit, in my mind, a bit flattened. And it's not really about even what the content of these novels are. It's just how they're perceived, how they're talked about. And it plays into this narrative often of like, Kathy Park Hong has a great essay about that in the book she released this year, Minor Feelings, mm-hmm. where she talks about how like Asian immigrant narratives are often predicated on individual mm-hmm. growth. This idea of like someone with this dream and like under like really difficult circumstances, they persevere and they sacrifice and they gain acceptance, that kind of thing. Like that's growth, individual growth. But like what, there's so many other layers to explore in that, like particularly in how mm-hmm. a kind of racist capitalist system can actually keep an individual, sort of confine an individual and make it so that an individual can't grow or can't even see themselves as an individual. And so I wanted space for this book to be like whatever it wanted to be and to explore like, yeah, characters changing and growing, but also like these characters, I don't know if they want to change. I don't know. There's a limit to how much they can change. Mm-hmm. And there's different reasons for that. And so I wanted to give them the freedom to be that. And also I wanted this book to have the freedom to be other kinds of books. I wanted it to be a Texan book. I wanted it to be, mm-hmm. you know, a book about family, or just, I don't know, just there's all these other categories it could fall under. It is a kind of pressure. I don't quite know how to navigate it, but it is an immigrant novel. And I think it, but it's just about allowing it to be more than that as well.
Right. And I think you articulated it exactly. It's like, that's become a genre kind of like, that's become a label that's very different from just saying these are two elements that are a part of like the object that you're holding, you know, like we've come to talk about that in a very specific way. I haven't read Minor Feelings yet, but I think she's like just a genius. So I'm not surprised at this, but I'm excited to read that essay. And I talk about this often on the show too. Like I am from and write a lot about Appalachia, and it's a different set of kind of prejudices and assumptions that you're dealing with. But I get very defensive about how things are, you know, well, is this the sort of story that we've read 1,000 times that just like, you know, and I think, you know, I'm much more fluent, obviously, in the kind of trappings of that sort of story. But for me, thinking about that, you're either very, it's either this very hard scrabble kind of rural existence, or you're romanticizing it in this kind of just Pollyannish, like, you know, living at one with the earth kind of way. And there's just not a lot of room for nuance or reality in any of those. And I think this novel it's kind of all nuance. Because everybody is like, everything is subtle and everything is ambiguous enough that there are all of these kind of everybody's constantly, I feel like, trying to find their footing and not quite finding it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you. I'd be curious to hear about your experience in dealing with that, like the sort of narratives that have been projected onto you and in your work. And sort of how to respond to that, because I think at the end of the day, maybe it is in allowing things to be ambiguous and allowing things to be specific, like allowing this to be like the experience of specific characters rather than stand-ins for a kind of population that is,
absolutely,
you know, yeah, really hard to categorize. But I do find myself sometimes caught in this trap where I'm like, okay, like, okay, I don't want these characters to be model minorities, so I'm going to make them do the exact opposite of what like model minorities are supposed to do, right? Like,
right,
none of them can be good at math. And it's like, well, it's okay if one of them is good at math. It doesn't like, you know, there's this, I think you're still, I still feel myself sometimes centering those like outside narratives in my response to them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Or like the outside, like, I mean, this is such a, it's become such a term, but like the outside gaze.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit right on this topic of, I was just reading your essay about universality on LitHub. And it was, and I'll link to it on the show page. People should definitely go read it. It was on the occasion of the wonderful movie, The Farewell. But you talk a lot about this idea of when we talk about things being universal, not only does that kind of flatten a specific experience and sort of rob it of its significance so that it can apply to everybody, but also like even the use of the term universal is kind of assuming that outsider gaze that we're talking about, that like we can, you know, like you have to preface everything by saying like, don't worry, this is for you too. And it, you know, it feels a little accommodating in maybe an uncomfortable kind of way.
Yeah, I struggle with that because it's like, I know that like when someone, if someone were to call my book universal, they would have like the best of intentions, like they're trying to say something nice, but at the same time, it's like if you really unpack that word, like can writing ever be like universal? I mean language and geography aside, there will always be groups of people who are not going to experience it the same way, or will have trouble accessing a certain part of it. Because we all just have different contexts in which we're coming from, and that's within like Asian Americans or Chinese Americans that would read my book too, right? So yeah, I mean, I sometimes I feel like by calling something universal, we're often saying that it reflects a life that is sort of already sort of reflected, if that makes sense. It's like it's praising the book's ability to give access to people who are used to getting access, and that somehow is the status quo for like what makes a book universal. So yeah, I just don't think it's like a useful question, because we're all like learning when we read to like slip into other people's minds and slip into their characters, and yeah
absolutely. And I mean, like, I think there are, you know, there are, of course there are emotions that are universal. There are like, you know, you can kind of break down into these like sort of lowest common denominator like categories of like, okay, you know, difficulty connecting with a parent is a universal, you know, something like that. But it's like, by the time, what you have to strip away to define it in those terms.
Yeah, and I don't think we have to read to find similarities between us as readers and the characters.
Right.
At least that's not how I read. I think, it's just not really the point. And I think I'd rather just be challenged. I'd rather be made slightly uncomfortable, because I think that allows me to see myself more clearly too.
Right. Right. Along that line, was there any kind of a conversation about including, because there's some Chinese language kind of peppered through the book. There are some expressions in terms of endearment and that sort of thing. Was that something that you did consciously?
Yeah, absolutely. I you know, just felt like another way to center the characters and their perspectives, because for them, you know, Mandarin is not foreign, and the way that like they would incorporate Mandarin alongside English and sort of build this new language is also very much like quote unquote normal to them. And I was actually interested in thinking about how certain English words could be foreign to them. And like, I think Patty at some point ruminates on the word shithead.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I think that's what it was.
Like
makes no sense when you like, I understand these two words separately, but
And I love sort of reorienting language that way to like bring out the weirdness and limitations even of English through a different perspective. There's an amazing story by Gish Jen called Who's Irish that was really important to me, in which like it was the first time I'd seen a narrator who was this like Chinese grandmother, and it was written in like first person and like quote unquote broken English. She was able to capture through that perspective like actually more or less the limitations of the English that other characters were using, and how they thought certain words like were enough, but really like their sentences were totally vague and meaningless. And it was this outsider to the English language that was able to notice these things.
It reminds me too, what you're saying of a while back I had Pam Zhang on the show, and she was talking about her debut novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold. And she said, you know, we were having a similar conversation about the language in the book. And she was saying that, you know, in large part, she wrote the book for the characters of the book. Which I really loved. And this idea kind of translates for me too with what you're saying of like this particular, they would be mixing and the kids would be saying things like shithead and like all of these weird sort of like combinations that would get introduced kind of into the family vocabulary make perfect sense for those people.
Yeah, yeah. I love Pam's book, and I could totally see that in it felt so natural to the rhythms of her prose too.
Totally.
It would take me out if like suddenly, you know, she's translating the Chinese and like, you know, stepping out of the book to say, hey, like reader who doesn't know this word, let me, you know, take a moment to explain. And yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, likewise here in this book, because it's so often, there's a tremendous intimacy in the way that it exists in this book, because it is so often, you know, because it's this family that is a little bit mysterious, or, you know, as all families are, like, you know, it's kind of hard to you know, as we've been saying, get your footing about them all and about them all, their relationships with one another and as a unit. And so it is this very private, you know, and especially I think that's most salient when the there's a very official a stranger who comes to the house in a very official capacity, and Patty is kind of barking instructions to the kids in Mandarin before she's asked to only speak English kind of in this woman's presence.
Yeah Like, I think these characters are using language, and their different experience levels with language can be a way of creating distance between them, especially among generations. You know, I think about this and like, what are the kind of conversations I can't have with my grandpa because I just don't have the vocabulary to have them. At the same time, it's in certain moments, it can be a way of finding immediate kind of commonality, or even having this space that you can protect for yourself. And that's, I think, what Patty and Annabelle were trying to do in that moment, but because of the circumstances, they weren't able to.
Have you joined WMFA's Patreon community yet? Patreon is a digital platform that allows fans to support creators and their work directly. When you become a patron, you pledge a monthly amount of your choosing, and I give you rewards like exclusive writings, notes of creative encouragement, and bonus segments, including a bonus segment from this very episode. That reward, by the way, is just $2 a month. By joining my Patreon community, you're growing the world of WMFA one writer at a time, plus supporting a whole community of independent creatives, from audio editors to graphic designers. And creative community is what WMFA is all about. Join today at patreon.com/WMFA podcast. That's patreon.com/WMFA podcast. Thank you for supporting the show.
Well, let's maybe transition a little bit to just talking about kind of writing more generally. You have an MFA, you've studied writing, so I assume you've kind of been writing forever, or did you come to writing at a particular moment in your life?
Yeah, well, I guess big writer as a kid. I would, my parents would take me to work and sit me down at their cubicle because they're both working full time. And I just often spend that time writing and binding the pages together and like making a cover and then like making a little like bookstore at home where I would try to sell it back to my parents. I was actually more like, I was more like That's a amazing. Business person, if anything. I guess there was an art to it, but it was more like, you know, I knew that they would feel this pressure to buy it. You know, it's better than like what other kids could be doing with their free time. So yeah, I mean, I've always enjoyed writing and reading. And but then, you know, there's that period of my life in like high school or where I kind of went away from it because it didn't seem like something that I could be, even though I knew writers obviously existed. Writing was something that I eventually tricked myself into taking seriously and sticking through. And I mean, for better or for worse, like MFAs are incredibly prevalent now, but it helped me to like get that confidence to try out being a writer, and it gave me like you know, a stipend, and you know, it was fully funded, so that was very helpful. Yeah, so I just gradually found my way back to it.
Right. You know, sort of however any one writer chooses to do it, I feel like that kind of that process of formalizing it is very important. You know, whether it's an MFA or just some, you know, workshops or whatever it is that like helps you take yourself seriously as a writer. Cause you're right. I know so many other writers who agree with this, and I am the same way. Like, you know, we grow up as these like voracious readers and writers, but even still, it doesn't occur to us that it's like a real thing that people can get to do. And so you kind of, there's the cognitive dissonance between like, well, I know that these books that are in my hand were written by somebody, but how does one become that person?
Yeah, I think that's when a workshop is working well, is like, it feels like this protective bubble where for the first time, like people are talking about your writing seriously as if it were a book that's out in the world. And that's, I think, really important for people who are not yet like ready to call themselves writers. Like, I think that's an important thing to experience. I remember like, you know, in that experience can happen outside of a formal workshop. Like I remember, what was it? Maybe like eighth grade or something. Like one of my English teacher, like I remember she picked out an essay just randomly from the bunch. We were writing personal essays and it happened to be mine. And she really got into it and was doing all the voices and gesturing and like, and she was a really good reader. And to just see her like take my words seriously like that was really important to me. And I think a workshop can do that as well. Though on the flip side, it can also, if it's sort of run poorly, can also feel like you're putting your work up on trial. And that's also, you know, that can be discouraging too.
Yeah. What an amazing memory. That's such a good story. Yeah. I love that. I hope that teacher knows what a big impact
they have. I know. I've been trying to find her. I would like her to know that too.
I came across, as I was preparing for our conversation, there is a small, you know, you have like a kind of little entry on the McDowell Colony website that mentions that you found out that you sold your book while you were at residence.
Yeah, yeah.
It just seems incredible. Congratulations. What a cool moment.
Yeah, it was wild. I mean, it was logistically kind of difficult because cell phone connection there is really bad. Sure. So I remember getting some emails from my agent that my eventual editor was interested and wanted to talk first about sort of her ideas. And I was just like, yeah, very nervous for that phone call. And I had to like take it in the common room. And sort of some of the writers were sort of in the corner and they could hear little bits and they're like, oh, this sounds serious, but also good. And, but yeah, I mean, I really don't know if there's a better place to receive news like that than around other writers, because they got it. You know, they knew what that meant.
Yeah. Yeah. How does writing fit into your life now? Do you write full time or write and teach? Do you have a day job?
Yeah, I mean, it's not full time. I'm doing some like virtual teaching. I'm trying to, you know, mm-hmm. get a teaching job, which is getting to be increasingly harder in this environment. I'm actually living in a city bordering Plano right now, where my parents live, sort of in this transition stage where I'd finished my fellowship. I had a fellowship in Tulsa, Oklahoma for the past 3 years, and I was also teaching there. And so I'm sort of done with that. And the original plan was to move to California, where my wife is a student there. But because, you know, her classes are online, we're back in Texas and trying to figure it out. But it is much cheaper to live here.
Right. Yeah. I just, a few days ago, I spoke with Ann Helen Peterson, and she's in Montana and I'm in Maine, and we didn't actually really talk about it that much, but it is funny, this sort of like, I feel like there's been this kind of bigger movement lately of maybe just like anecdotally of writers I follow on social media, like seeing people like leave bigger cities and just being like, well, I can do my work well here in the middle of nowhere, or like in this, you know, smaller city that's not New York or LA, and kind of have something like a quality of life.
Yeah, I think that can be a good thing, because like, yeah, you really can write anywhere, and you can still connect to like New York industry people virtually. And, you know, it's like, you don't necessarily have to live in New York. I do miss like aspects of like the literary community that I'm starting to discover in Dallas, but sure. I do hope that maybe one silver lining of this year is that people feel like that writing can be more accessible, and that they don't have to feel like, because they don't live near like San Francisco or New York, that they somehow aren't part of the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've had conversations with writers since, you know, everything happened, who, you know, had books kind of come out on smaller presses or things like that, that they're just like, now I can have a book tour. Like, I wasn't going to be able to travel to all of these places, but like, now I'm like doing these virtual events, and, you know, not at all to make it to a, like, isn't there actually a great positive to this? But I think, you know, eventually these are some interesting takeaways that like, there is something really valuable about having an aspect of this connection that is virtual and more accessible.
Yeah, yeah. And I think with teaching too, and with people wanting to take creative writing classes, like sometimes the idea of like just upending your life and moving and doing an MFA program, it's not feasible. But like, there's so many like cheaper, more affordable, like virtual workshops and things like that. I do think like these are things that probably should have been happening before now, but at least it's become more normalized, and I hope it keeps going like that as well as the in-person component, because I do miss that.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Do you write every day? What's your writing kind of pace like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very different now, because I'm like, you know, I'm working on various projects. Like, I'm writing some essays that are somewhat related to the book. It's been a while since I've like really had this focused long project like this novel. And when I was in residency in Oklahoma, I was able to write every day. That was a great like privilege of mine. I don't know what sort of writing will look like in the future. I try to carve out time every day, but I'm also trying to take it easy, especially this year.
Yeah, for sure. I just moved this year also. And so everything has been like extra upheaval. And I got this piece of advice, like, just try like spending some time just like reading your work and not feeling like you need to do anything else with it. Right. And it just, some days it feels like that's like all I can do is just like, okay, well, I reread this draft. And I think like just the kind of like, I don't know, I was at a residency once, and a visual artist was saying like about her studio practice, she was like, I have to touch it every day. And I like that idea of just like, you just have to like, you at least have to like make contact.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, I think that's one of the things I love about just writing and, or just a life in the arts in general, is that like, I mean, in all the other parts of my life, I'm more like a planner, and I'm fairly organized person, but I'm trying to give myself permission to be more chaotic in my writing process, because I think that's where like the writing feels most alive anyway. For me, at least, when I'm like able to be organized in the other aspects, like I feel very free to then just like go a little wild in how I write. And, you know, maybe one day I'll be like writing till 3 a.m. because I just want to chase this thread in my head and I don't want to let it go. And then another day, yeah, it's more like I'm revising or I'm just reading someone else's work and I'm just letting things influence me in a sort of more mysterious way.
Mm. I love how are you finding giving yourself permission to do that? Because I'm very similar. I'm maybe a little too type A in the rest of my life. And so sometimes it can actually really stress me out, kind of the chaos of my partner is a composer and he's always like, yeah, but the mess is fun. And I'm like, I can't get there to feeling like the mess is fun. Messes stress me out so much.
I totally get that. When you pick up a book at a bookstore, it looks very organized. It looks very pretty on the page. I think it's just kind of reminding myself, okay, think about how messy your process was to get your book up there. Like, there's all this crap behind this book that, you know, it's not in the presentation. And just reminding myself that all other writers are going through this and it actually can help them, right? It's like not a kind of like X input equals Y output. And that's what I love about writing.
I love that. Yeah, that's great. I'll try to steal that for myself.
I'm constantly struggling with that too. I say this, but then I don't follow my own advice.
Oh, that's what this whole show is about. That's fine. Yeah. That's a great segue to the last question that I always like to ask at the end of my conversations here, which is what does creative satisfaction look like for you right now?
Creative satisfaction. Yeah, I love this question. I feel like with students of mine in the past, we've sort of circled around this question because like oftentimes I have students who are extremely talented, but they're like quite hard on themselves and they seem to never be satisfied. And I want to just tell them like, oh my gosh, you're like writing amazing stuff that's way better than anything I could manage when I was starting out. But also like I've started telling myself this too, but that your perpetual creative dissatisfaction may be coming from this like growing self-awareness. Like you're becoming a deeper reader, you're being a closer observer of the world, you're growing into language, you're growing as a human being. So like when you begin to see the bigger picture, it's hard to be satisfied, right? You feel like you have farther to go. So I feel like I'm going away from your question, but like, I guess creative satisfaction to me is to be content knowing that, like, it's okay. I have far to go. And that actually may be a good thing, like to know that your best creative work is always at some point in the future that maybe I'll never reach. That actually somehow comforts me.
Yeah, exactly. And I love how you framed that of like the dissatisfaction often coming from growth and feeling like, okay, well, now you know more about how to make something even better. And so you're seeing cracks maybe where you hadn't seen them before, things like that. That's great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. This was really fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this was great. I really appreciate the time you spent and your questions. Helped me see my book in a different light too.
Oh, I love to hear that. Wonderful.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at WMFApodcast.com. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review on iTunes to help new listeners find the show. Have a question or author recommendation? Email me at hello@WMFApodcast.com. Find me on Twitter and Instagram at CFBallister, or leave a voicemail at 347-685-4836. Today's episode was edited by Andy Cubis. The WMFA logo was created by Unsold Studio, and our theme music is Jazz Dancer by Double Winter. Find them at doublewinter.bandcamp.com. WMFA is part of the Lit Hub Radio Network and is made in Pittsburgh by Courtney Ballastier, LLC. All rights reserved.